Presbyterian Fellowship, as we now return to the text, finish out here chapter 4 in this respect, as this particular section, we title The Glory of Christian Suffering, verses 12 through 19, beginning with the subject of and the fact that suffering refines believers, verse 12. Looking at the Greek here, beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal among you. Our case of address here, the vocative case, the pronominal adjective, agapetos, beloved, agapetos. We saw Peter use this term, which affected his believers back in 2 verse 11, where he referred to them as beloved. Do not be surprised. Do not be surprised is the negative ne in the plus the imperative, present passive, of the verb exenizo, exenizo. That which is literally used for stranger, here more metaphorically, for one who is surprised. Same verb in the same way used back in 4 verse 4 in regards to unbelievers being surprised with respect to population separating from them. Do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal among you. Fiery ordeal here is the dative case with the definite article of the noun hagurosis, hagurosis. It's used three times, literally means burning, and that's his only other two uses. It's used in a literal sense in Revelation 18. Of prophetic Babylon and judgment upon it, verses 9 and 18. Figuratively, as in our context, it means that the fiery ordeal or painful test. Used three times. Do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal, burning, among you. Among you is a preposition in, locative location, plus the pronoun sue, in the plural you all, in the church, which comes is the circumstantial participle of manner here, present deponent, the verb ginomai, G-I-N-O-M-A-I, comes into reality, which comes upon you, pronoun sue, again repeated, you all, in the plural, for your testing. You had the preposition pros, indicating direction towards their persons, followed with their noun for testing here, accusative masculine singular of pyrosmos, pyrosmos, P-E-I-R-A-S-M-O-S. Which comes upon you for your testing, as though some strange thing were happening to you. As though is your comparative adjective or comparative conjunction hos, H-O-S. Then we have the cognate of the verb, translated surprised here, exenos, X-E-N-O-S. Here, the genitive case, the additive used predominantly, a strange thing, something that is foreign, unheard of. It's used 14 times, as though some strange thing were happening to you. Were happening is the adjective, compound adjective, sumbino, S-U-N-B-A-I-N-O. Here's adjectival participle, present active, were happening, coming about, taking place, used eight times, to you, again, pronoun Sue here in the David case, with respect to these believers. Rereading verse 12 here. Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal among you, which comes upon you for your testing, as though some strange thing were happening to you. All right, the analysis of verse 12. 1. Verses 12 through 19 comprise the final paragraph of chapter 4 in the Greek text, as Peter again specifically addresses the issue of undeserved suffering. He briefly left the subject of suffering to direct the believers' attentions to their responsibility towards one another as members of local churches, of the church universal, to complement the resources for which they had to draw upon in regards to dealing with their undeserved suffering in life. And now, here in the final paragraph, he comes back to the issue specifically of undeserved suffering. So that's the flow of his thinking. 2, his thoughts here are spurred from the doxology ending verse 11 of glorifying God, quote, in all things, end quote. Directly relating that glory now to the believer's suffering. We are to glorify God, as the doxology brought out, through Jesus Christ, in all things, verse 11. And that does not dismiss or excuse the aspect of suffering in the believer's life, especially undeserved suffering. So that thought spurs his thinking now back to the issue of suffering, to include that aspect of our life in which we are to glorify God. So 3, this adds the glory that will be bestowed upon the believer that glorifies God in their sufferings. So his thoughts are spurred from the doxology, ending verse 11, of glorifying God in all things, directly relating that glory to the believer's sufferings. This as the glory that will be bestowed upon the believer that glorifies God in their sufferings. Verse 13, to the degree that you share the sufferings of Christ, keep on rejoicing, so that also at the revelation of His glory, commensurate with His glory, you may rejoice with exultation. And then compare verses 16 and 19. But if anyone suffers as a Christian, let him not feel ashamed, but in that name, let him glorify God. And then verse 19, the call to suffer according to the will of God, entrusting their souls to the faith of the Creator in doing what is right. Hence, a direct application of glorifying God. So 4, now he once again addresses these believers with the term of endearment as beloved, agapetos, the same as case of address as used back in chapter 2, verse 11. 5, the plural of the noun, beloved, would literally be translated beloved ones. 6, and in 1 Peter 2:11, in addressing the believers at that point in time in his epistle, 1 Peter 2:11 emphasized their status as a people for God's own possession, in verses 9 through 10, with then the responsibility to isolate the SCA and witness to a negative world, where he addresses them back into chapter 2, verse 11, he addresses them beloved. This falls on the heels of declaring their citizenship as God's own people for His own choosing, as a chosen race, and as a royal priesthood. And in that vein, he then exhorts them to isolate the STA in representation or ambassadorship as being the citizens of this new heavenly kingdom in verses 11 and 12, I urge you as aliens and strangers to abstain from fleshly lusts which wage war against the soul. The inner conflict, he brings out, in regards to the indwelling STA, seeking to compromise our positive volition with respect to life, and keeping your behavior excellent among the Gentiles. Gentiles technical for unbelievers, those around them, and their witness to those around them. The most important thing is to keep their sin natures overruled sufficiently, not to bring about a stumbling block to them with respect to their particular lives as believers, so that in the thing in which they slander you as evildoers, they may on account of your good works, as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation. So there, he emphasizes the status as God's, as a people for God's own possession, then with responsibility to isolate the STA and witness to a negative world. 7. Now, the emphasis in our verse here, once again, referring them to them as beloved ones, the emphasis in our verse harks back to their faith's true willingness to operate with intense divine love and grace towards like-minded positive volition, as so stipulated back in verses 8 through 10, as he finishes off recognizing the importance of positive volition of application towards one another in service to one another as they seek to run their course in the midst of the angelic conflict. And the emphasis there, here obviously, is on that aspect of divine love, to love, keep above all, keep fervent in your love for one another. Then with the particular emphasis and examples that he brings out under the package of divine love. So 8, now together, verses 2, chapter 2, verse 11, and his use there, and his use here, together, the two uses indicate believers that are worthy of God's love. Isolation of the STA, application Bible doctrine. Those who are worthy of divine love. So 9, just to know that the Father loves us as we are aligned with Bible doctrine is comforting in times of trouble and sorrow. To know that God is on your side, He has your best interests at heart, metaphorically, in regards to your life, to love you. That's true love, that is righteous love, that is divine love. And when we are, as believers, faced with our tests in life, persecution that may come our way, obviously a comforting thought is to recognize, in spite of what others may think and how they may act towards us, God loves us. And He has our best interests in mind, even with the principle of facing undeserved suffering in our life. So 10, to have the assurance of God's love during these times is essential, as trials and persecutions are to be considered the norm in the Christian way of life. Our persecutions, testings, things of this nature, this is all part of the normal aspect of living a Christian life. Communicators should instruct believers early on in regards to their Christian life that because they're on Bible doctrine, somehow they're now immune in regards to testings and persecutions if they're doing it right. That's the way some pastors implicitly teach. You know, this like the health and wealth approach. You know, if you're living your Christian life right and applying the right doctrines, then God's going to make you wealthy. See, well, he missed the boat in regards to Paul. I guess Paul really messed up in regards to his life. See, all fallacious. No. Suffering in our life, testing our life, it's normal. Everybody has their tests. That's just living life in Satan's world. So we live in a world that is antagonistic and not conducive truly to God blessing it in its maximum way. And hence, you're going to have tests. And testing is part of the normal way of life. We call this common human problems. CHIPS is the acronym we use, CHPs. And 1 Corinthians 10:13, no testing, literally, has overtaken you, but such is common to man. And God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tested beyond what you are able. But with the testing will provide the way of escape also, that you may be able to endure it. So, testing, situations in life that tax us in regards to pressure in life, etc., is common. It's part of life in and of itself. And obviously, to know, again, that you have the omnipotent being of God that has every intention to provide the best for you according to your own spiritual, volitional well-being is very comforting. Sometimes it can be one of the final doctrines, last doctrines to fall back upon to find comfort in the midst of sorrow, grief, and things of this nature. God still loves me. No matter what else is going on, I've got God on my side. He's not forsaking me, in spite of what it may seem in regards to others. So, obviously, love, in that respect, is very important in life in and of itself. It's like having a spouse or a parent or whatever, a friend that continues to love and care for you in spite of things that may not be going exactly the way you would like it to go in your life. And to have that comfort there. So God is, in regards to those who are positive. So to have the assurance of God's love during these times is essential, as trials and persecutions are to be considered the norm in the Christian way of life. So 11, this fact underwrites the paragraph. To understand this principle, this is what Peter loves to do. He likes to bring out the principle implicitly. And he stands upon that in regards to bringing out the teaching otherwise, such as the underlying doctrine and importance of Bible doctrine and how that opens the doors in understanding all the verses fully that follow in that regards back in chapter 1, the doctrine of the human spirit and all those verses that fell in place, see. And here, obviously, the fact that underwrites these particular verses is that God, obviously, expresses love under the attribute of love with respect to believers, and that does not dismiss even the times at which they are under severe persecution and testing. So 11, as part of the normal course of life. So 11, this fact underwrites the paragraph and gives cause for Peter's opening exhortation. Do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal among you, which comes upon you for your testing. All right, to break this down, 12, the phrase, do not be surprised, me exemnizo, literally means stop being surprised, the negative with the imperative. It means stop doing something. So 13, it would be normal for some among their ranks to be taken aback by the intense hostility perpetrated by the cosmos, as if being a believer made them immune otherwise. Believers, fairly young on doctrine, these believers were beyond immaturity. They were considered to be at least an adolescent stage in this time in history. But the intensity of antagonism and opposition that they met, obviously, would catch many off guard. How can something so pure and so benign in regards to his passive approach in regards to life of those around him meet with such hostile opposition in life? I mean, you think about it. What are we adhere to? It's not jihad. No, it's a doctrine. It is a truth says, no, be passive. Love your brothers. Love your neighbor. But yet, a face in regards to this world, it has been attacked and receives the greatest of hostile opposition that is available in regards to life in and of itself. This particular, quote, religion, end quote, using it in that vein, that we adhere to. And for those who see this, excited about it, want to express themselves and witness to others, getting on doctrine, and they meet this kind of opposition, people that go negative, and this is why it's so important to understand that, the doctrine of volition and negative volition and what that means versus positive volition, and people that are negative, to be so hostile in regards to seeking to embrace the faith of Christianity. And many believers, obviously, based on this intensity, would kind of put them in shock, if you will. As if, again, that somehow now they should be immune to this because they're loving God. You love God in Satan's world, you just pick the opposition to embrace in regards to living in this life. The angelic conflict. 1 John 3:13. And this section of Peter deals with the angelic conflict and this intensity and this persecution and why it exists. To let the cat out of the bag. John exhorts, do not marvel, brothers, if first-class condition, assuming true the conclusion, if the world hates you, and it does. Now, again, hate runs the spectrum in regards to simple disregard. It don't have any care in regards to, you know, a person disregards their child while they're not doing anything physically necessarily to harm them. They still hate their child. They're not taking care of them. It's a form of hatred. All the way to, obviously, the greatest overt hatred, and that is, you know, killing people over things. But the world here is negative volition, the cosmos, that which we refer to as cosmos diabolicus, from the devil's world, Diabolos. He is the ruler of this world. You gotta understand that. Jesus Christ has gained legal victory, but logistically, physically, in reality, experientially, Satan still rules in regards to this planet. And how he rules is through negative volition and the STA, embracing human viewpoint and expression of the STA in antagonism towards God and His plan. Satan is openly declared archenemy of God. He is the dark side. And commonly, you have the world seeking to tempt you to come to the dark side, to give up the truth, to compromise in any way we can. In any area that we're willing to compromise, understand the world is predisposed, has a predisposition to stimulate this kind of response from people. And considering the fact that we are of such minority of existence in this world, do I need to, again, hark back the importance of why Peter brought in the importance of being a part of a local church, the camaraderie, the unity, etc., and harmony we should strive to have with one another, because we are facing, if you will, numerically, a very lopsided battle. But just because we are facing a lopsided battle, numerically, does not mean necessarily that we don't have the power to win the battle anyways. Where does that power come from? Jesus Christ. One little word will fail Him. Jesus. Now, that's a pretty little word. A little word. See. God. However you want to express it in that vein. So, we all face testing in life. As Peter is now bringing out, that testing can be extremely intense. In regards to persecution, that's the main thrust, even though obviously we can apply this in all aspects of our test in life, but specifically is persecution coming from other people in regards to our faith. And just because you become a believer, does not mean you now become automatically immune to this persecution. No, you've set yourself up as a primary target to be the one that the cosmos, with the support of Satan and his agenda, to take pot shots at. Try to trip us up in regards to our stand for the truth and serving God in this regard. So 14, the verb surprised here is the same verb describing negative volition in their response to the behavior of adjusted believers, as we saw back in 4:4. He uses the same term intentionally to hark back to verse 4 in regards to negative volition being surprised, because now they have pulled away from these believers from their pagan heritage, from the even civil aspects of life that's expected from them, because of the obviously STA precedence that is behind all of it, assuming for themselves a new course of life in isolation of the STA and staying separate in regards to the evil that's otherwise perpetrated by the negative cosmos, Roman authority, etc. And they, these negative unbelievers in this case, are surprised that you do not run with them in the same excess of worthlessness, and they malign you. Again, the verse looks at the positive believer separating from negative volition and their activities and things they associate with in life. And they are surprised. They're taken back. You know, you've been doing this before. As long as you keep socializing, keep embracing them, they won't be surprised. Yeah, that's fine. Oh, hey, you got a new religion. All right. Come hang out with us at the orgy anyway, you know. And we're still fine. We're still good buds. All this other stuff. And you go, well, you know, I've never had this fiery ordeal in my life. Well, maybe you haven't, you know, surprised any of them yet. Surprise comes when you make the application. See, until you apply, there will be no surprise on their part. But anyway, the verb that he uses here in regards to the believers not being surprised is designed to provide the contrast back to negative volition being surprised at the response of their behavior now in opposition to negative volition. So 15, the negative command used in our verse, in contrast, states that it does not follow for believers to react with surprise at the actions of the cosmos. While they may be surprised, Bible doctrine in our soul, what the cosmos does in return, or in what they may do even overall, shouldn't take us off guard. It shouldn't catch us unaware. Bible doctrine teaches us about the STA. Bible doctrine teaches us about negative volition and antagonism to the truth. So why should you be surprised under Satan's rule? Negative volition in this world does the stupid, unbelievable, evil things that they do, including their antagonism and attack in regards to those who are positive. We are not to be caught off guard. Now, we're not talking about, you know, some things. I mean, people don't have a norm regarding certain areas, and that's something just totally out of clear blue that some expected entity. You know, we're not talking about that. We're talking about being surprised in regards to the overall texture of the cosmos in regards to running under their STAs and the extent that they will take it. And we are not to respond as negative volition did to us, as that catching them off guard, and they're looking at, that's really weird. You know, where's that coming from? We are to understand that when one is running under their sin nature, they are rejecting Bible doctrine. What they do is simply an extension or manifestation of that very thing. And again, we know the degree that the STA can take people to in regards to the evil that they enmesh themselves in. So the negative command used in our verse, while the others are surprised, we are not to be surprised. In contrast, states that it does not fall for believers to react with surprise at the actions of the cosmos. 16. Now this sense is confirmed here in the verse, in the final comparative clause, as though some strange thing were happening to you. So 17, the cognate adjective strange here, exenos, is used in the final clause to complement the verb surprised. So 18, the adjective figuratively means something foreign or different, such as in Hebrews 13:9, suggesting that what the negative cosmos does under the SCA should indeed come at no surprise. Hebrews 13:9. Do not be carried away by varied and strange teachings. See, something that's foreign to you. Some insinuation or some proposition that does not harmonize in regards to the sound doctrine that you've been taught otherwise. That's strange, see. So figuratively, the term strange means something foreign or different, suggesting that what the negative cosmos does under the SCA should indeed come at no surprise. Now, they complement. But don't be surprised, which literally means that term means someone strange, as it's used in the doctrine of hospitality, a foreigner, a stranger, etc. So 19, the cognate verb and adjective together emphatically declare that believers are not to regard suffering brought on by persecution as a strange or alien phenomenon. Something that, if you will, is out of the norm. Believers, positive volition, have been persecuted since the beginning of time. Start with Cain and Abel. Abel was positive, Cain was negative. And Cain persecuted Abel. Killed him. And it's been that way ever since. The conflict truly began in the garden. Under Adam and Eve's disobedience to God. And that conflict was manifested in their first pair of siblings that they had. So, people that take issue with you in regards to your stand for Bible doctrine, instead of going, oh, what is that all about? You need to recognize, man, that antagonistic doctrine, number one, they're negative. Number two, they're leading with their sin nature. They're not willing to isolate it, etc. So the cognate verb and adjective together emphatically declare that believers are not to regard suffering brought on by persecution as a strange or alien phenomenon. 20, believers are to be aware that antagonism and suffering from the source of negative volition is a natural and expected thing. Like I said, when you get on doctrine, and especially getting on sound doctrine, you pick the most elite force of opposition that is available in this world against Satan and negative volition. If you will, is of the highest calling in regards to believers doing battle in the angelic conflict. And antagonism and suffering, obviously, therefore, should be expected in persecution in regards to our stand for those who are not willing to embrace doctrine at the level that we and the purity of which we seek to embrace it. Some may, you know, have no real mood one way or the other in regards to it. Some may embrace it, some of it, and reject some of it. Some may embrace all of it at one time and then reject it. You know, it comes in different forms. And the persecution comes in different forms. And persecution is not just simply limited to unbelievers. Against believers, it also includes believers against believers. So 21, Jesus taught his disciples to expect these things from the negative cosmos. So I am here as your shepherd to make you aware that in your witness to others, seeking to bring forward Bible doctrine as the issue at hand in whatever subject it may be, and you run across those who are negative and reject the truth and they respond to you, you can possibly expect, in not all cases, but a lot of times you can expect, based on, you know, how negative they are, antagonism expressed back to you in this respect. John 15:18-21. Jesus states this succinctly, and why? If the world hates you, and it does, first class condition, again, know that it has hated me before it hated you. The world evidenced that they hated Jesus Christ. They killed him. Sent him to the cross. His own people. That's about as close to home as you can get, see. And while we may be persecuted, understand that Jesus Christ is persecuted first for his stand for God and his plan. If you were of the world, and he continues to address them, here you have a second class condition, and you're not, because they are believers of God's kingdom. The world will love its own. Negative volition gravitates towards negative volition. But because you are not of the world, and I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. Because you have set yourself in opposition in regards to negative volition. Those who reject the truth, understand, they will hate you. Remember the word that I said to you, a slave is not greater than his master. Verse 20. If they persecuted me, they will also persecute you. Who you follow, when you pick someone to follow, the types of pressures and persecutions they come under based on their philosophy, ideologies of life, you put yourself in position to be associated with those same types of persecutions and sufferings. And if they persecuted Christ, then you can expect it. Based on his stand for Bible doctrine, what he stood for in life, you can expect the same thing to come your way. They will also persecute you. If they kept my word on the other end of the coin, they will keep yours also. Those who are positive otherwise, they'll embrace you and they'll like you in that sense. See, they won't persecute you, they'll support you. But all these things they will do to you for my name's sake. Everything is based on the reputation of the person of Jesus Christ. See, his reputation. His reputation was he was God in the flesh and he was perfect. And every word he spoke was truth. That was his reputation, see. And we cling to that. That's how we seek to build our own reputation. It's the very reputation which the Christian faith is built upon. His reputation. True Christianity. Not funny, this funny stuff that's out there. This lukewarm, tavern-puking approach regarding the Bible doctrine. For all these things they will do to you for my name's sake, because they do not know the one who sent me. Again, whatever rhetoric they may give in regards to God, God the Father here, the one who sent me, that's who that has in view, God himself. They don't know him. The God that they know is something totally different, whether they try to visualize it as a supreme being of the universe or whatever. They have no true knowledge in regards to who and what God is. So Christ taught believers to expect the same aspect of persecution and suffering from the negative cosmos. So 22, Peter then speaks of their sufferings as a fiery ordeal, which is, again, hate, perosis. 23, the noun literally means, quote, the burning. The burning. Not unlike the sense of way young people might use this term today, burn. You know, somebody gets reproached or put down or whatever, they call it a burn. That recognizes the kind of sense of where this is coming from. So the noun literally means the burning. 24. It is used three times, with its other two uses literally a prophetic judgment against the U.S. by God in Revelation 18 and 19 and 18, or 9 and 18. That's the only other two uses we have, and it's literal. Revelation 18, 9, 17 and 18 in chapter Revelation presents Babylon in two forms. Chapter 17 centers on religious Babylon, which is Roman Catholicism, the universal church in that respect, seeking to have control over governments and nations, etc. Chapter 18 deals with prophetic Babylon. And truly, the best candidate still today in regards to fulfillment of prophetic Babylon and its destruction that's described in this chapter is our own country. It is definitely not dealing with literal Babylon. You put it together with Jeremiah 50 and 51, passages in Ezekiel and Isaiah, etc. You see the people, you see it all over the internet in regards to the fundies, you know, talking about Iraq, and this is the Babylon, and it's going to be wealthy again, and they have all this power, etc. And that's because of their misinterpretation in regards to Revelation 18. Now, the Babylon, other passage tells us Babylon is surrounded by water, or our country is surrounded on three sides by water. Iraq is surrounded by sand. I'm surprised they don't have an over-influx of cat population over there. Big sandbox. I guess the camels do. Let's see here. Revelation 18:9, our term. And the kings of the earth who committed acts of immorality and lived sensually with her, prophetic Babylon, will weep and lament over her when they see the smoke of her burning. That's our term. That is the destruction in 1 hour, one day that occurs upon this country through nuclear holocaust. And then verse 18, same thing. And we're crying out as they saw the smoke of her burning, saying, what city is like the great city? The city, you got to understand its use in regards to a city-state. Babylon was a city, but it described a nation. So it's used two other times, and both literally in prophetic judgment against the U.S. A fiery judgment. So 25, metaphorically, in our verse, it emphasizes the intensity of the unrighteous judgment that negative volition makes against positive volition that brings about undeserved suffering. The intensity of unrighteous judgment to judge positive volition as being evil, things of this nature, who are serving God, people that are in fellowship, applying Bible doctrine, to judge them as anything otherwise, and from the flesh of men, according to the standard of the STA, is unrighteous. And it is unrighteous judgment that brings about undeserved suffering, see, for the believer who's willing to otherwise line up with doctrine. So here, the burning is the intensity of this unrighteous judgment that Satan sponsors in the cosmos, directed towards positive volition, bringing about their undeserved suffering. So 26, Peter expects his readers here to recall the doctrine of God's vindicating righteous judgment, in contrast, as his blood, to counter any tendencies to react in shock. When these things occur in a big way, some of them just kind of be, you know, little match burns or whatever, but sometimes, you know, people can come out with all-out attacks, verbally, otherwise. And when that occurs, obviously, preceding all this, Peter is told and instructed these believers that God is going to ultimately vindicate them, and that vindication will be under righteous judgment. In contrast to the unrighteous judgment that is being expressed to them otherwise. And therefore, don't react in shock. Help that offset that when these kind of tests come to you. You got to look at the doctrine. See how you think is going to govern what you do in the midst of these tests. And if you're not thinking doctrine, then you're obviously not going to apply at the level at which Bible doctrine is designed to help you apply at. To have this inner peace, inner happiness, and all these other things that would be associated with it. And one of them is obviously falling on the promises in regards to God ultimately under righteous judgment, vindicating believers as He has hammered on throughout the epistle. 1:17, and if you address Father as Father, the one who impartially judges, see, that's under righteous judgment, according to each man's work. Conduct yourselves in fear, that's righteous fear, during the time of your stay upon earth. That says the premise in 2:23. And while being reviled, Jesus Christ, He did not revile in return. While suffering, He uttered no threats, but kept entrusting Himself to Him who judges righteously. Recognizing, obviously, Jesus Christ is a premier example of ultimate vindication. And then 4:5-6, in regards to those who are surprised at Paul's volition, they shall give account to Him who is ready to judge the living and the dead. That will be done in a righteous way. For the gospel has for this person been proclaimed even to those who are dead, though that they are judged in the flesh as men. That's one way judgment occurs. They may live in the Spirit according to the will of God. In spite of that, they can put themselves under the righteous judgment of God. In contrast. And Peter, obviously, has been teaching all that for believers to be able to grab a hold of doctrine in this respect. To understand that, don't be surprised. And part of that is recognizing God ultimately will vindicate those who stand for the truth of His Word. So 27, this, quote, painful trial, end quote, that postulation faces, recognizes a severe test of faith and endurance brought on by persecution from negative family, friends, associates, and strangers. You never know where really intense testing in this regard will come from. It may even come from your closest associates, like Judas Iscariot and Jesus Christ. That's a pretty close associate, was it not? And it can come from family members, it can come from friends, or just complete strangers, or business associates, school associates, things of this nature. Those who are antagonistic to the truth. They're locked into their human viewpoint, sacred cows, and you bring out some point of doctrine that goes against that, and they lash back at you. And read you the riot act, and, you know, it can go on from there. So the severe types of tests that believers face as they seek to persevere in the Christian faith and walk by the truth of Bible doctrine. 28, Peter then characterizes the fiery ordeal as being for your testing. That's so, assume, pros, pyrosmos. 29, the noun testing here is the same noun that was used back in chapter 1, verse 6. And it is to be interpreted with the same idea in mind. In this you greatly rejoice, even though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been distressed by various tests. It's our term for trials. And he tells you why they rejoice, because it is the evidence of your faith. Being more precious than gold, the refining process of testing, obviously, is designed to produce regards to positive volition. Even though tested by fire, that the proof of your faith, verse 7, being more precious than gold, which is perishable, even though tested by fire, may be found the result of praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. So, Peter essentially reintroduces this thought as it applies now, not to just any testing, but even the most severe testing. So the noun testing is the same noun as we saw in chapter 1, verse 6, and is to be understood in the same vein. 30, that is, it is through the various tests that believers encounter that provides a way to refine or purify their faith as fire refines gold. The refining process regards to precious metals being put to extreme heat is designed to remove impurities from that metal and making it more valuable. It's worth more. And tests that come upon the believer's life is designed to do the same thing on behalf of positive volition. Testing on behalf of negative volition, it does nothing other than, you know, suffering the time deserved in that sense, generally speaking. But for the positive believer, it's designed to increase the value of what we are in regards to being positive. And that obviously has a direct effect in regards to our spiritual advance as well as our SG3 package. So 31, it points to the fact that our testing in life is designed to benefit our spiritual advance in order to maximize our SG3 as a refining process is to gold or silver. Again, is producing more value. 32, when people do bad things to us, in connection with our adherence to Bible doctrine, that's your caveat. And you might want to underline that. When you're dealing with adherence to Bible doctrine, not rejection of Bible doctrine, not compromising Bible doctrine, not your own human viewpoint approach, but when people do bad things to us in connection with our adherence to Bible doctrine, it is a good thing, as it accomplishes something that would not have have been possible otherwise. If we all just lived a life with no tests, you know, what would we have? You might think utopia. Well, eventually, yeah. But in regards to evidence, in regards to our life and our eternal mission, which we are carving out in time. And if we had no testing, we'd have essentially no other way to really evidence and prove that we're positive. And people can fake it so easy. You know, everything's going good for you. Oh, man, that'll be nice. But when adversity arises in regards to the individual life, then their true color truly shows. It comes out. See? And then you have opportunity to apply Bible doctrine at a level otherwise not there. And you also have opportunity to acquire SG3 at a level that otherwise would not be there. The difference, like giving someone a glass of cold water versus someone who is facing being martyred for the faith. You know, the SG3 that they're going to get, the magnitude of it, obviously is going to greatly differ, even though God's faithful in both cases of rewarding. So, Bible doctrine teaches you to look at life a little different than the way the cosmos does. And when people want to attack us for the faith, you don't like it to happen. I mean, nobody normally wants that to happen. It's a good thing because it gives us opportunity to see where what we're made out of volitionally, where we stand, how positive we are and our willingness to endure and therefore evidence the fact that we are positive. 33, testing is designed to accelerate our spiritual advance and provides opportunity for SG3 not otherwise accessible. 34, the more severe the test, the greater for spiritual advance and level of reward. 35, this is true of all kinds of testing, not just abuse from the source of people, even though that's the main subject here. 36, the Christian communities to whom this letter was originally sent share common tests, namely persecution sponsored by a pagan environment. 37, it is assumed to have political backing, as we know in history, as seen in Nero's assault on the church in Rome spreading throughout the empire. That's brought out in Revelation chapter 2, the 10 rulers who would bring about a period of testing in regards to the church. So 38, the words "for your testing" here express purpose. And the purpose of all testing is to accelerate and refine spiritual growth, greatly enhancing our SG3 package. 39, once again we see that nothing happens in our lives that God does not work for good if we love Him. That's your caveat. Once again, that's your stipulation. That's the requirement. It's working for your good. Even severe persecution is working for your good. As it goes in regards to your spiritual advance, as it goes to evidencing truly the meat of your positive volition, as well as your eternal wealth and power and authority and privilege and things associated in regards to our phase three. So 40, this reminder is designed to help us better cope with suffering that is undeserved. And it is working with the Bible doctrine we have learned for our spiritual and eternal betterment. 41, suffering of this sort is not, quote, strange, end quote, but is to be expected and is commonplace in the lives of godly saints throughout the ages. 42, Peter desires that his readers not react with shock under the social ills perpetrated by negative volition, but focus on the fact that they are doing them a favor. Father, again, we thank you for the truth of your word. We ask God, Holy Spirit, to be enlightened to see these things in Jesus' name. Amen. Thank you.